This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning around Australia and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, Homeward Bound. The Australians stuck on board a cruise ship are finally off and on their way to Darwin.
Whether it be crew or whether it be us, we all want to just get off this damn ship.
And on the hunt, could Australia's foreign spy agency be used to track paedophiles and terrorists here? Most of the Australians who were on board the Diamond Princess cruise ship are now on board an evacuation flight due to land in Darwin later this morning. But because of serious concerns about the ship's quarantine standards, they'll have to spend another 2 weeks in isolation in Darwin to make sure they don't spread the virus when they return. Our North Asia correspondent Jake Sturmer reports from Tokyo's Haneda Airport.
Busloads of Australians, escorted by police and rolling towards freedom. All were wearing masks and being driven by officials in full protective outfits. Australian Vera Koslova-Fu was on the bus, and for her the departure couldn't come soon enough.
Whether it be crew or whether it be us, we all want to just get off this damn ship. Basically, not because they've mistreated us or anything, it's just this whole ordeal. We just want to get off.
More than 150 Australians have finally escaped the confines of the cabins they've called home for 2 weeks. But not everyone was so lucky. At least one Melbourne woman tested positive yesterday, and her family decided to stay with her on the ship. This outbreak came from an 80-year-old passenger from Hong Kong who'd had the virus while on board in late January, but authorities only discovered he tested positive after he left, and what he left behind was a trail of infection that has spread throughout the Diamond Princess, leaving more than 600 passengers and crew in hospitals across Japan with the virus. And now questions are being asked about just how this situation spiralled out of control. Professor Kentaro Iwata, a Japanese doctor who volunteered on the ship, blasted his government, saying the most basic of protocols hadn't been followed.
The cruise ship was completely inadequate in terms of the infection control. There was no distinction between the green zone, which is free of infection, and the red zone, which is potentially contaminated by virus.
Vera Koslova-Fu is just happy to be off the ship. She says she considered turning down the ticket and travelling around Japan instead, but ultimately there was just too much uncertainty because Australians who don't take up that evacuation flight won't be allowed back home for 14 days.
That daunting, is it just the 14 days, is something that is nobody can confirm. So if Australia decides that, oh no, the pandemic is getting worse, so you're going to have to stay away, you're not allowed to come in, then we are basically stuffed. So that's the crunch. Am I happy that I'm going to be going into another 14 days of quarantine? Absolutely not. But I am happy I'm going to be on Australian soil.
And firmly on Australian soil for some time. She says she's in no rush to get on another cruise ship. This is Jake Sturmer in Tokyo reporting for AM.
Canberra public servant Deborah Winkler and her husband are also among the Diamond Princess evacuees on board the Qantas flight to Darwin. As they prepared to leave the ship, here's what the captain told departing passengers over the PA system.
Tonight our disembarkation process continues for those guests from Australia, New Zealand, China, Hong Kong and Macau. We bid you all a fond farewell and wish you a safe and pleasant journey home.
Our reporter, Eleni Soltis, was listening to that too and asked Deborah Winkler how she felt hearing that final farewell.
Look, it's been a long 2 weeks, I have to say, and we've been ready to go for a while now. Yeah, we would like to be going home, as in, to our own home. But, now we're just glad to be going back to Australia and being on our own, in our own country.
Have you been tested yet?
Everybody's had a swab test. They were completed, I think, by Monday. We were tested on Sunday. They told us it would take 3 days for those tests to come back. So that's where you've seen, different cohorts of people kind of each day being tested as positive because they've done the tests progressively. We've had our temperature taken, and we'll be wearing wristbands when we get onto the plane with some kind of barcode on them. I assume they scan that somehow for information in relation to all the different passengers on the plane.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Oh. This announcement is for all Australian and New Zealand guests. We would like to invite guests with an orange wristband. Please proceed to deck 4 forward gangway. Thank you.
Is that you? Do you have an orange?
No, we're green. I think we're last.
Why did you decide to go on the Qantas flight and not stay back in Japan?
Few unknowns, really. Like, would we be able to go home on the 4th or the 3rd? You know, what if there was, you know, further outbreaks here? And either way, you know, we need to get off the ship.
What are you looking forward to once you get home?
Lots of fresh air and a bit more sunshine. I'm hoping that when we're at Howard Springs, I'm assuming we're still going to have to wear face masks and things like that. What we're, you know, most looking forward to is when we get back to our own house and, you know, we can do things in our own time frames. We can eat when we want to, see our gardens going okay. We can talk to our neighbours. We can catch up with family and friends.
I suppose the silver lining for you is once you go back to Canberra, there is no more smoke.
Yep, that would be a bonus. And there's been some rain.
Diamond Princess evacuee Deborah Winkler speaking there with our reporter Eleni Soltis. A community is in shock and a major police investigation is underway after the death of a family in suburban Brisbane. Three children died after the car they were travelling in was set on fire and their mother, Hannah Baxter, died last night. It's alleged the children's father, Rowan Baxter, set the car alight before dying on the footpath. Thomas Aretti has this report and a warning. There are some distressing details.
In broad daylight, Camp Hill became a crime scene. A car was found alight yesterday morning before emergency services arrived to a shocking scene. Three children, all aged under 10, deceased. Their mother, 31-year-old Hannah Baxter, was taken to hospital and died last night. The father, Rowan Baxter, died on the footpath from self-inflicted stab wounds. Joanne Yates is the CEO of Domestic Violence New South Wales.
For women who leave their partners, the time just after they leave is the most critical for them and for their safety. I can't speculate on the current case, of course, at the moment. That is subject to a police investigation. But we do note that he was estranged from her and we think that probably has some importance in the case.
There are still a lot of details we don't know about the Baxter family.
I'm Rowan.
And I'm Hannah. And whether you're just getting started or whether you already have some experience, we would love to hear more about how we can help you improve your health and fitness journey.
Rowan Baxter was a former New Zealand Warriors NRL player, and until recently he ran a gym with his wife. But it's becoming clearer that the idyllic life captured in family photos didn't tell the whole story. And Joanne Yates says while she's waiting for more information from the police, family violence continues to be a critical problem.
The prevalence of domestic violence across Australia is incredibly wide, estimated to cost the economy $22 billion a year. They were estimates that were presented to the Victorian Royal Commission back in 2016. So even impacting on our economy, it's absolutely huge.
Professor Kerry Carrington is an expert in gendered violence at the Queensland University of Technology.
The most risky time for a woman is in fact during the first 6 months of separation. That's when they're most at risk of being killed by an ex-partner. So we do know that. In fact, we do know a lot that makes crimes like this preventable.
But there's a lot we don't know. A major investigation's underway and police have spent the night at several crime scenes.
Thomas already there. And if you're in an abusive situation or know someone who is, call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, call 000. Australia's foreign cyber spy agency could be used to track pedophiles, terrorists and other serious criminals living in our own backyard under a proposal currently being considered by the federal government. The Australian Signals Directorate, known as the ASD, is restricted under current laws to hacking, disrupting and destroying criminal cyber activity overseas, but that might be about to change. Our political editor is Andrew Probyn. Andrew, good morning. What exactly is under consideration?
Well, security agencies say the problem here, Sabra, is in piercing the dark web, which is a largely ungoverned section of the internet where trade in things like sex crime, drugs, terrorism and weapons is found. Australia's best spies and those who work for the Australian Signals Directorate are restricted to hacking, disrupting and sometimes destroying hostile or criminal cyber activity that's overseas. And if they come across such activity being done in Australia or by Australian citizens, they must stop immediately. So the government is, with the advice of Australia's intelligence agencies, wants to change that regime, in effect to give the Australian Signals Directorate an expanded remit to allow cyber spies to be used domestically in support of other agencies, but particularly the Australian Federal Police. And I spoke about this with Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton.
We wouldn't tolerate a suburb within any capital city where the police weren't able to enter that suburb and execute a warrant issued to them by a judge. We wouldn't tolerate it. And yet we tolerate this with the dark web. Our kids are living their lives online through devices. People are being groomed online, young children, young women. They're being sexually exploited and their lives destroyed. And yet we have an effective area of our Australian community, perhaps in the virtual world, perhaps online, but it's completely lawless.
Now, Andrew, civil liberties always come into play during these discussions. What's the response been to this idea outside of Canberra?
Well, not warm. On the face of it, of course, it sounds like an eminently sensible notion that you would allow Australia's best cyber investigators to help law enforcement agencies, you know, track and prevent serious crimes such as child sex abuse. But remember, ASD has military-grade capabilities that's among the best in the world. It's been used, for example, in the fight against Islamic State and the Taliban. To have this extraordinary ability in deterring foreign cyber attack used potentially domestically is problematic for folk like the Law Council of Australia. And we can hear now from the President of the Law Council of Australia, Pauline Wright.
The Australian Federal Police is the body that ought to be investigating people within Australia. And the Australian Signals Directorate is set up quite differently and has quite different standards in terms of the safeguards and protections. We're concerned that any expansion of their powers that would enable them to investigate domestic incidents would be inappropriate.
Now, Andrew, this all sounds a little familiar. News Corp journalist Annika Smethurst reported in 2018 that the heads of Defence and Home Affairs Ministries had discussed powers allowing the ASD to spy on Australian citizens. That publication of those reports later prompted a raid on her home by the AFP. How is this different to those reports?
Well, what happened to Annika Smethurst points to the great political sensitivity and controversial nature of this proposal. The government said at the time that Annika Smethurst's story was wrong insofar as she suggested mass surveillance of the population. Well, the government says it would be proposing nothing of the sort. But this does point to the challenge ahead for the government if it does pursue this plan. I understand it's quite advanced. It would have to satisfy concerns that extending the potential reach of Australia's best cyber spies would not be in breach of Australians' rights and freedoms. It would also require, quite obviously, some tight safeguards surrounding this to protect Australians' privacy.
And that's our political editor, Andrew Probyn. You're listening to AM. Thanks for your company this morning, and it's 14 past 8. There's been an extraordinary claim made in a London court that Donald Trump offered Julian Assange a pardon if he'd say that Russia was not involved in leaking Democratic Party emails during the 2016 US presidential election. Our Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley was at the court in London.
Well, Sabra, today at the Westminster Magistrates Court, Julian Assange appeared for his last hearing before the extradition hearings, which will begin next week. Now, during that, his lawyer, Edward Fitzgerald, asked the judge if he could tender some more evidence to be used during that hearing, and she agreed that he could do that. One of the pieces of evidence he said he'd be using next week was a statement from another lawyer of Assange, Jennifer Robinson. Now, he says, he told the court that in that statement, it would look at a visit from a former US Congressman, Dana Rohrabacher, to Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy, where it's alleged during that meeting that Rohrabacher offered Assange a pardon if Assange agreed to basically say that the Russians had nothing to do with the 2016 presidential campaign leaks. Now, Edward Fitzgerald, the defence lawyer, told the court that that meeting came after an instruction from the US President Donald Trump. So basically what we've got there is Assange being offered a pardon, an alleged pardon, if he agreed to say that the Russians had nothing to do with those 2016 Democratic Party document leaks during that presidential campaign. So quite explosive, really, Sabra.
Yeah. Has President Trump responded to this?
Yes, very quickly, in fact. His press secretary put out a statement saying the allegation is a complete fabrication. The president says he barely knows the former congressman at the heart of that allegation, that he's never spoken to that congressman about Julian Assange. But, of course, there'll be many questions now for Donald Trump throughout today and for his minders, and I'm sure his opponents will really want to make quite a big deal of these really quite explosive allegations.
That's our Europe correspondent, Samantha Hawley. China's government will expel three Western journalists, including an Australian, in a sign that media is becoming the next battleground with the United States. China's government says the three Wall Street Journal reporters had their press credentials revoked due to a headline in the newspaper that Beijing deemed racist. But many believe it was retaliation for a US move to publicly call out Chinese media outlets as government propaganda. From Beijing, here's China correspondent Bill Birtles.
Usually when Beijing kicks out a journalist, the government waits for their visa to expire and doesn't give them a new one. But the Chinese government is now cancelling the journalist visas for the Wall Street Journal trio over a headline none of them had anything to do with. Earlier this month, the prestigious US masthead published an opinion piece by an American guest author, which editors headlined, China is the real sick man of Asia. It was a piece about China's coronavirus epidemic, and the headline referenced a saying used to describe a historical period when China was poor and weak. Of the three reporters they're now booting out, one, Philip Wen, is an Australian who last year co-wrote a piece revealing the cousin of China's leader Xi Jinping had gambled tens of millions of dollars at Melbourne's Crown Casino. Mr. Wen told AM he's unable to comment, but after 7 years in Beijing, he's been given 5 days to pack up and get out. Cedric Alviani is from the Press Freedoms watchdog group Reporters Without Borders.
By revoking the credentials of three Wall Street Journal reporters, the Beijing regime shows again a blatant disrespect for press freedom.
He says Beijing's move is very likely retaliation for a White House decision to designate five Chinese government media outlets in the US as foreign entities, treating them like diplomatic arms of the Chinese state.
There is a huge difference of nature between the Chinese state-run media that officially carry the Chinese Communist Party's propaganda and an independent media outlet like Wall Street Journal.
China's state media in recent years has flooded Western social media, free to access international audiences, while Western media outlets, including the ABC, remained censored in China. Aggressive nationalism is also on the rise, promoted by a ruling Communist Party that punishes foreign companies, governments, celebrities and sports stars if they're deemed to offend China's honour. In a statement, the Foreign Correspondents Club of China described the move to kick out the reporters as extreme, saying,
Correspondents and their colleagues in China are suffering from an increasing frequency of harassment, surveillance and intimidation by authorities. The expulsion of these three reporters is only the latest and most alarming measure authorities have taken.
According to the club's tally, 9 foreign journalists have now been forced to leave China since President Xi Jinping took power in 2013. This is Bill Birtles in Beijing reporting for AM.
Fruit growers demanding the federal government step up biosecurity measures to keep out a highly contagious citrus disease. Citrus canker has struck Australian fruit growers before in 2004 and again in 2018, costing the industry millions of trees. Now it's been found in produce that airline passengers were attempting to bring into the country. Political reporter Alexandra Beach has more.
At the Nutrano farm near Katherine this morning, staff are preparing for the latest government biosecurity inspection of their lemons and grapefruit.
There's two guys. They have to inspect 2,500 plants out of our orchard. Each plant is randomly chosen, and they make sure that there is no canker in the orchard.
Josh Clemenson is the farm's general manager. While they've never had a case of citrus canker on the property, the farm was in the quarantine zone during an outbreak of the disease in the Northern Territory 2 years ago, and it still has heightened biosecurity measures in place.
We put people through dips. We don't let people drive through in their own vehicles. We give them a vehicle if they were to go to the citrus area. After we pick, we only use our own trucks to transport the fruit to our pack shed. And then it's we've put in a special chlorine doser to dose all the fruit that goes through the shed for the lemons and the grapefruit.
All of these biosecurity efforts are being made because citrus canker is highly contagious. It covers the fruit, leaves and twigs of a tree with raised brown lesions. It can kill a backyard tree and affect the quality of the produce on commercial farms. And now Nathan Hancock from Citrus Australia says people have been caught trying to bring infected fruit into the country.
They're unrelated passengers from what I understand, one with fresh limes and one with some dried fruit. Each has had citrus canker lesions on the fruit.
It's why Citrus Australia is urging the federal government to increase spending on biosecurity.
The people that we've found with this material actually self-declared. Now, what if someone doesn't pay attention to the request to declare items as they come into land? The gaps of that creates makes our industry and other industries very nervous.
In a statement, the Department of Agriculture, Water and Environment's head of biosecurity, Lynn O'Connell, says the recent detections show Australia's biosecurity system is working well. And she says visitors to Australia aren't the only risk. A member of the citrus industry was fined in 2018 after biosecurity officers found a diseased kumquat cutting hidden in his bicycle tyre. While Northern Territory farmers hope to have citrus canker eradicated by the end of the year, farm manager Josh Clemenson says the nation can't let its guard down.
You've got to be really diligent. You know, you never know what's around the corner.
That's Northern Territory farm manager Josh Clemenson ending Alexandra Beach's report. Eucalypts are the iconic Australian tree, but years of land clearing for farms, mines and homes has put the long-term survival of dozens of eucalypt species at risk, as Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
The eucalyptus tree dominates the Australian landscape, from the bush to our parks and backyards.
There's something about a natural Australian forest dominated by eucalypts, this signature tree of our continent.
Ecologist Rod Fensham has spent decades studying the trees and they've never lost their allure.
It's also the smell, you know, they've got this really distinctive smell. So you know when you're in a eucalypt forest and it's the essence of Australia, I reckon.
But the University of Queensland professor is warning that despite their apparent abundance, these forests are in serious decline.
So you can have species that are still reasonably common, but because of our land use change through the course of European history, they're on a trajectory of extinction.
In a study published by the journal Biological Conservation, Dr. Fensham and other scientists from the National Threatened Species Recovery Hub found that almost a quarter of Australia's 820 eucalypt species are threatened, including the black gum and the Camaruca mallee. It's the first time all eucalypt trees have been assessed under the globally recognised guidelines known as the Red List of Threatened Species. Land cleared for mines and housing have contributed, but the study found farmland had wiped out the most trees. And the worst rate of decline is in Western Australia.
The popular name for the area of concern is the Wheat Belt.
Professor Steve Hopper, Chair of Biodiversity at the University of Western Australia, was another contributor to the study.
It is a major cereal growing area in Australia, and it just happens to coincide with a global biodiversity hotspot.
While the encroachment of farmland is difficult to stop, Professor Hopper says some reforestation efforts might help.
If we are to have a sustainable agricultural industry, we need to redress the decline and, if at all possible, reverse it by strategically planting forests.
Study co-author Rod Fensham has a more drastic solution.
Further clearing has to stop, and, you know, any bits of bush that are of a reasonable size in that part of the world are absolutely critical for the conservation of eucalypts and biodiversity generally.
Not all of the eucalypt species identified as threatened by these researchers are on Australia's official threatened species list. But they're hoping that with the public concern about how this summer's bushfires have jeopardised the survival of many plants and animals, some of Australia's gum trees may also start to attract a greater conservation focus.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting there. Dozens of communities in the Murray-Darling Basin are counting down the weeks until the release of a review into how the water from the nation's largest river system is shared between the states. But one New South Wales town is already very pessimistic about the outcome, with residents worried it'll become a ghost town due to a lack of water allocations. Gavin Coote prepared this report.
Yeah, hi. Can we order a coffee, please?
Yeah, no worries. What would you like? Just a large cap?
Yeah, large skin.
It's renowned as the oldest town on the Namoi River. But some worry about WeWar's future.
Look, it's been really tough for the last 12 months, and I think we've really come to a dire period.
Anne-Marie Gallagher is the president of the WeWar Business Chamber. The northwest New South Wales town is dubbed the country's cotton capital, but the industry's not doing that well. Keepit Dam, which the town relies on for its flows, is still at less than 8% capacity, despite all the recent rain.
If we don't have irrigation, what will we do? If people move away from WeWar, that's an effect to all our local services in town. Yeah, look, I do think things are being determined from people that are not going to be directly impacted.
The people she's referring to are state and federal water ministers, and while they're waiting for a report from the former Federal Police Commissioner, Mick Kelty, into how the waters of the Murray-Darling system are shared between the states, Anne-Marie Gallagher says many in WeWar are already worried that the goalposts will be moved and local farmers won't be given access to the flows they rely on for crops.
We need to make sure that it's going to be equitable for all those users, and I think there's been enough facts put forward that they could make a better decision than the one that they're making at the moment.
If water allocations change, the ripple effects will be felt throughout the town. WeWar cotton farmer Colin Morrison doesn't get too bogged down in the politics of water, but just desperately wants the dry times to end.
Looking back over the history, there's been lots of droughts, but not I don't think as bad as this one. So it's just a matter of people cutting back.
Yeah, keeping them, I guess. Is that the concern that some people are leaving town?
Yeah, well, some people are leaving if they see a chance of getting a job in the mines, or they might take that as a short spell.
Originally from Sydney, Matt Bullock made the move to WeWar to work at a local cotton gin. But with very little cotton being grown, there's not much work going.
I can honestly tell you it's a great lifestyle out here. Unfortunately, it's a hard lifestyle with the water that we don't have.
He now works as a pool technician, servicing the whole northwest, in what would usually seem like a lucrative business.
But at the moment, because people are getting laid off as farmhands and they're doing their own maintenance on their pools.
Even though Mick Kelty's report, along with another national review into the use of water for environmental, agricultural and critical human needs are both due within weeks, Matt Bullock is tired of waiting for reform and feels many in WeWar have now fully disengaged from the process.
You look at the township of what has and hasn't dropped off as industries, it's just a snowball effect. if the drought goes on for too much longer without either the state or federal government doing something about it, then we're going to have a premier and a prime minister that presides over the death of our country towns, and the National Party members that are out there, state, federal and local, will literally be the members for ghost towns.
That's Wee Waa businessman Matt Bullock ending Gavin Coote's report. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
Something very strange just happened in Ireland. Sinn Féin, a party verging on socialist with historic links to the IRA, just won the popular vote and might even form government. And it's all because of young people.
Today, how living at home until 35 politicised a generation. And could it ever happen here? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.